On Radio Gorgeous today, I'm happy to be talking with someone who expresses the little voice in our head that we try to ignore. Ugh, you're ugly. Look at your double chin. I'm not as pretty as her. Oh, my stomach is fat. In fact, Am I Ugly? Am I Ugly is the name of her memoir and self-help book. She is Michelle Ellman, and she's a member of the body positive community and a body life coach. Hi, Michelle. A warm welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Hi, thank you so much for having me on.
So tell us about your childhood. Your book starts when you're 11. Why that particular age?
I think 11 was the first time I could accurately recall my surgeries. I vaguely remember the one when I was 7, but the ones before that, it's really hard to write about it because it's actually just what I've been told rather than what I remember. So the first big set of surgeries were when I was 11, so it just made sense to start there.
Now, let's say, why did you have surgeries? Can you tell people what condition you were born with?
So the summary of it is that I've had 15 surgeries over the course of my life, and the first one started shortly after the age of one. The first surgery was a brain cyst. And then they weren't really sure why I wasn't lifting up my head as a baby. So they diagnosed me with hydrocephalus, and then over time it got a bit hazy as to whether I actually still have it or not, because without spoiling the book, I go through a number of things, which carries on all the way through my childhood, and my last surgery was actually earlier this year, so keeps going.
Okay, so you just, it's a part of your life now.
Yeah, exactly.
So, you were sent age 11, because that's, again, the age when girls are sent to an all-girls boarding school. How did you find that? Because you're actually from Hong Kong, and you probably lived in Hong Kong up till then.
Yeah, so I lived in Hong Kong until I was 11, and then I got told I was going on a big sleepover across the world. And it, to be honest, for the first year, it felt like that, until I started getting really bad migraines and really bad dizziness, and then I started fainting a lot. Up until that point, I loved boarding school, and everyone's like, oh, but you're halfway across the world from your parents, like, how did you not miss them? But because it was so busy and you were constantly surrounded by people, and at that age you were in dorms of like 10, 11, 12 girls, you didn't really have time to miss your parents. You were just surrounded by your friends, and it was this new fun thing, and there were new people in your life, and I really enjoyed it for that first year. And then it was only once I went into hospital, everything kind of changed. And
yes, because the teachers didn't pick up on your what was happening to you, and you didn't, because that's one of the things in the book, you're always sort of slightly in denial. I'm not going to get ill again. You put it off, don't you, till the last moment. And you went into hospital, and it was very serious, and you missed a lot of school, didn't you?
Yeah, so I think the main thing for me was I never wanted to be accused of being a hypochondriac, and like I knew that when I raised the red flag that I was being ill, it led to very extreme, like, okay, we're going to fly across the world and fix you and save you and spend loads of money on all your surgeries. And even at 11, I kind of understood that. And what I wanted more than anything was just to be normal and to be like my friends. So I was like convincing, I wasn't just trying to convince the teachers that I was fine. I was convincing myself that I was fine. But it was pretty obvious I wasn't fine. And so ended up having to fly over to America, because at that point, and this is more than 10 years ago, there was still very little known about hydrocephalus. So hydrocephalus is a buildup of CSF fluid or water in the brain. And at that time, no one really knew that much about it. They definitely didn't know anything about it in Hong Kong. And they were just, England was still behind LA.
Just to let you know, we're always 10 years behind America.
Yeah. Okay. I think it's just the difference between
Private and health, yeah, and national health.
Exactly. Yeah. And also just the motivation to because they benefit so monetarily from it over there.
Exactly.
And there is just such a difference. Yeah. And so that's kind of why, was because
so you were flown to LA, but not to Hollywood, to a hospital.
No, to a hospital. And landed in, sometimes I think my life was made for a book, because I landed, and as if that wasn't enough, there was a shooting across the LA motorway, which meant I arrived in the hospital to emergency room, which was covered in blood, covered in vomit. Like, everyone was bleeding, holding gunshot wounds all over the emergency room, and I was just like, have I just walked into a horror movie right now? Because I don't even watch movies. Like, I was like 11, not being allowed to watch movies like that, and I was like, I'm literally seeing this before my eyes. And then just like, it was an evening of just like being pushed back and pushed back because everyone around me was had much more severe cases. And then they discovered that my shunt, so I live with a tube that goes down my neck, which is called a shunt, had broken. But the scan had said it hadn't broken. And then I went into the, and then they were like, let's just have an investigative surgery because something's clearly wrong. And then they discovered it was actually broken, which kind of just leads to this like spiral of surgeries that follows one after another and means I end up in hospital for 3 months, which starts about a month. So it's like a month away from the summer term ending and then goes through into the summer holidays. And then I have about a month in Hong Kong at the end of the summer holidays before I have to go back to school for the beginning of the second year.
Wow. So can I just talk about the most serious aspect, which is you did die at one point.
Yes. It's really funny because it's strange for me to talk about it now because I never spoke about it. I never told anyone. Even at the time, I didn't really talk about it. I asked a few questions to the doctors about the fact that I could see everything in the room and that I remember seeing everything, but my eyes were shut at the time and I was told my eyes were shut. And
so you were looking down on yourself?
I was looking down from above, but also I had no like feeling or no sensations. So I was watching my parents like hysterically crying, thinking I was dead and feeling really calm. So I remember going back into my body feeling really guilty, being like, can you imagine watching your parents like bawling, crying on the floor and you feeling nothing? And so especially at 11, I went back into my body being a bit like, oh, I'm a bad person. I could watch my parents cry and not feel a thing.
So your soul left you, or your spirit, or whatever this magic thing is. We don't know what it is. And you literally left your body.
I went above the room. Mm. The pain left first. That was the first thing that left.
Wow.
And one of the nicest things that I'm able to say now is, and actually the first time I started talking about it was my friend's grandma had passed away. And it was the first time I'd ever said anything about the fact that I died. And I just turned to her and I was like, this is going to sound really weird, but when I died, it was the calmest thing ever. And in my head, that's just a really nice thought that, yes, like, no matter how people leave this world, they leave with this calm feeling, because the first thing that went was the pain. And then it was almost like all the stress, all the sadness, all the anger that I had inside me around everything that was happening had just gone. Mm. And I was calm and I was ready to go. Mm. And I think it had just been a build up of like 3 months of pain. And I was just like, honestly, in my head was like, I just like
you couldn't take it.
Yeah, I was like, I'm ready. Like, this is too much. Mm. But it was.
So how did they bring you back?
The doctor slapped me across the face. So the heart, the defibrillator.
Very, very modern technique.
I know. I mean, this is why I'm like, my life is almost too good for a book because it doesn't even sound real. But the heart defibrillators weren't coming out fast enough. So the doctor happened to be doing rounds. So he just slapped my face and it jolted my heart enough to not need... I mean, I'm CPR, not sure if you could do it now. Like, I've told this story to a few doctors and they're like, yeah, you'd be sued for doing that now. And I was like, but it saved my life.
Back to life.
Yeah. So I don't think anyone would sue you after you've just saved your life.
You wouldn't
sue. But yeah, my heart jolted and then I came back into the room. And what's quite strange about that moment was that right before I left, I didn't realise I was dying. So I didn't even hear the heart monitor going off. I just heard my mum hysterically crying. And I had an awful migraine at the time. And so I had said to my dad, can you just look after mum? But actually what I had meant was, can you shut mum up? Because she's giving me a really bad headache. But because my wording was, can you please look after mum? He thought that was my goodbye to the world.
Oh my God.
So like for a really long time, my parents were like, oh my God, you're such a good person. The last thing you said to the world is like, to take care of someone else, and like that was my goodbye to the world. And like I kept this secret inside of me that actually no, I just wanted her to be quiet because I didn't realize I was dying. But yeah, no, that was, I don't think I realized how much that event had an impact on me because I never mentioned it to anyone. I never talked about it until,
well, again, not mentioning and not talking about it will give you more of an impact.
Yeah, exactly. But it's the logical, rational thing in your brain when you're 11 years old.
When you're 11, you just want to, as you said, you just want to hang out and do sleepovers.
Yeah, and you want to fit in and you just want to be normal. And all of this stuff made me not normal and all of this stuff made me stand out. And that was the last thing I wanted to do. And because of how the school treated it, they kind of fostered this atmosphere of silence around all of it anyway. So I kind of just like went into what they wanted me to do anyway, because they didn't want me talking about the fact that, I mean, this isn't really a spoiler because it's the first story in the book, but like a lot of the teachers didn't believe me and one of them dragged me across the floor whilst I was unconscious. So it's things like that, which I guess they didn't want to talk about it from like a legal perspective because that shouldn't have happened. Mm. And so I just thought that was because like it wasn't a big deal. And I was always, from my parents' side, my parents had, my brother's like less than a year older than me. So my parents had already always brought me up with the idea that like I could do anything my brother can do. Like we were basically brought up like twins, and it was a great mentality, but at the same time, it meant that I never realised the importance of what I'd been through, and I'd never really taken a moment to be like, wait, okay, I'm allowed to be angry, I'm allowed to be upset. It's just like, at the time as well, a lot of the nurses were trying to keep me positive, so they were always like, be grateful, you have the best care in the world, be grateful, you survived because this reason and that reason. They would find every reason in the world to be positive, and I was like, that's the last thing I want to feel right now, like I'm just angry and I want to be in school and I want to... And it was always the small things that I used to think about. I used to think about the fact that like my friends were like, that we had this thing called muck-up day where like the older girls would... on the last day of school would just like cover it in confetti and cover it in silly string and things like that.
Be really naughty.
Yeah. And I would just think about days like that. And it's such small details, but it's the thing that you think about when you're 11 years old. You're like, I wanted that day. I was looking forward to that for the whole year.
Also, you said that, you know, you'd make brownies together and all those fun things.
And that's all I was thinking about in hospital. Like all the fun things I'd been looking forward to for the entire year, because it was notorious that it was like, it was just known that after exams, you would...
That's the fun bit.
Yeah, and it was like, it all paid off, all this hard work you'd done all year. And I was like, I was missing out. I'd done all the work, and I was missing out on that last bit.
God, really frustrating. So tell us about the school. It was a real hothouse, like you say. I mean, they really make you work hard. But it was also a bit of an anorexic environment. How did that affect you?
I think in general, the whole environment was like, it led to disordered eating. There was a lot of like banning foods, and there was a lot of...
By the teachers or the girls?
By the teachers, and then there were just like rules set in place. So in that first year, we lived in a house with just our year group, and we were only allowed to have snacks between 7:30 and 8:30. But you're not necessarily hungry between 7:30 and 8:30. But what would happen is, if you're hungry at 4 in the afternoon, you couldn't eat anything.
But that's tea time is exactly when you need food, after games.
And then, but what you do is between 7:30 and 8:30, you would literally stuff your face, even if you weren't hungry, even if you didn't want it, because it was like you knew it was going to be locked up at 8:30 and you'd have no more of it. Thinking back now, and especially in the work that I do, I'm like, that leads to disordered eating because you're not listening to your hunger whatsoever. And it's more the banning of it that creates this like... this feasting on it when it like for an hour, and it's just things like that. So for example, like fizzy drinks were banned from our school, and like a ton of this stuff, and like you were only allowed one cookie at break and things like that. Like it just leads to you not listening to your hunger.
But also, it makes you want it more.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if anyone says, oh, you're not allowed to drink alcohol, or you're not allowed to do this, you want it.
Yeah.
So it's like someone saying, oh, you're not allowed to smoke. I mean, everything you're not allowed to do. So they're saying, and young girls, the fun in life is eating and drinking when you're that age. You know, there's nothing else you can do, really, is there?
Yeah, and especially in a boarding school. We weren't allowed magazines. We weren't allowed TV. We had 1 hour of TV a day. We had nothing to do. Mm. And I think the difference in my school is because there was a competitive aspect to it, weight became part of the competitive aspect. And I think this happens in a lot of schools, and especially girls' schools.
Especially when there's no boys around.
Yeah, and when it becomes this thing of who can lose the most weight, who can be the prettiest, and then when boys are introduced, who can have the most attention with the boys when you go on these... We have these things called socials
where, I know them.
Like, you get on a bus and you have to, like, travel across the country to go to the boys' school.
Go to Eton, go to Harrow.
Those kind of schools. Yeah. And it was, it ended up being a competition. And I just think it was, there wasn't any intervention when it came to weight loss until it was too late. But there was always intervention when it came to weight gain. And I kind of talk about that in the book, that like as soon as, so I go on quite an extreme diet for about a month. And I lose a lot of weight. No flags were raised, no teachers had any concerns. But once I started eating again, the weight came on, as it does, because that's what your body does, it finds its set point. And suddenly all the teachers were really concerned that I'd gained 20 pounds in the space of 3 weeks, but no one cared that I'd lost 30 pounds in the space of a month. And there were even measures in place called heights and weights, where like they measured you to make sure you didn't develop anorexia because there was so much of it going on. But that wasn't noted because my BMI wasn't low enough to be underweight. So regardless of whether the fact that I lost 30 pounds in the space of a month, it doesn't matter because I wasn't classed as underweight. But then suddenly when I start gaining weight, everyone had something to say about it. Everyone was making comments about it. And there were just some awful sentences which stuck out in my head that teacher said to me.
Tell us one.
One was, oh, I'm so proud of you for not developing anorexia because someone at your weight would have done so by now.
Oh,
I was like, I'm not really sure if you're implying because I'm fat, I should have, what? Like, it doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
And even at that point, I was probably 14, 15. And even at that point, I was a bit like, I can't believe this is being said to me. And there wasn't such thing as like body positivity. No one really talked about body image in that way at that time.
I don't think it existed, really.
Well, it didn't exist, but also there wasn't the element of supporting someone with body image issues. So even in hospital, no one talked about, I remember when, spoiler alert, they told me about my brain tumour. The first thing I thought was like, you better not shave my head because I didn't want to go back to school. And I know it sounds really silly because like in the context of it, you're like, oh, well, you should be worrying about dying, not worrying about having a shaved head. But I didn't actually see that. All I saw was
when
going
young. That's all you see.
Yeah. And I thought about going back to school with half a shaved head and sticking out. And I was like, I don't like, I'm literally not doing this surgery unless you keep a layer of hair. I managed to negotiate until I got that. But it's things like that where no one had a conversation about body image, from like the scars to the hair loss to, I mean, even when I had a surgery when I was 19 years old, when I came out of the hospital, I was losing so much hair and I got really like scared that I had alopecia.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was sitting in the hairdresser's telling him about this and he was like, oh no, it's because of you had anesthesia. And I was like, No one told me that. And what's funny is I was talking to a friend who'd just gone to three surgeries and she'd never had surgeries before. And she just sat there and she was like, I'm losing so much hair and I don't know what's going on. And I was like, it's because of the anesthesia. And like, no one had mentioned it to her either. And I was like,
see, I've never heard of it.
Yeah. And this is the thing, like, unless you're the person going through it, you don't think about it. But even if you've gone through the worst surgeries in the world, if you come out of hospital and you lose hair every time you touch your head, you're going to start worrying about it. You're going to start worrying about
scars. Our hair is, especially for women, our crowning glory. Yeah, it's our identity,
like,
isn't it?
I also think it's like such a gender marker. So like when I lost my hair, the main thing I kept saying was like, oh, I'm not feminine anymore. I'm not a woman anymore because like I have short hair or I have a shaved head or like I have bald patches. Like no woman wants bald patches. And I was like, I have permanent bald patches since I was 11 years old now, and no one wants to talk about this. And so it is this thing of, I feel like it's really, I mean, it's why I started my campaign Scar Not Scared. It's why I talk about all this stuff now, is because I'm like, if you're going through illnesses, it's okay to worry about the superficial things. You aren't being superficial. It's a part of life and it's part of your identity. And when your body changes so drastically without like any, like you have no control around it, you're allowed to wobble about that. You're allowed to be upset. You're allowed to have whatever feelings you want to have at that time.
Now, what happened was you slowly made friends and found kind of people like you. And then in your sixth form, you sort of changed your attitude and you had a big turnaround in the school. Can you tell us what happened?
Yeah, so it was, it's really strange because I hate saying that there was one moment in my life where it kind of all shifted. But it really was that for me, where I was walking out of a sports lesson with a friend and she kind of looked in the reflection of a door. She was like, oh, damn, I'm so ugly. And this was the girl who I envied. And this was the girl who I thought if I looked like her, my life would be perfect and all my problems would be solved. And it was kind of that moment where I'm like, wow, if even she thinks that, then what hope do the rest of us have? But the funny thing is, she went on to talk about her thighs. And for the first time in my life, considering that I've idolised this person, thought she had the perfect body and thought she was the most beautiful person in the world, for the first time in my life, I looked at her thighs because she was complaining about them, which is naturally what you do when someone like talks about something, you focus on it.
Mm.
And it was this moment, it wasn't the most body positive decision, but I realized that every time I talk about my insecurities, I'm drawing more attention to it. So I'm just going to stop talking about them. But it accidentally turned into like the start of my confidence journey, because by not talking about it, people think you're confident. And by not joining in on those diet conversations and those conversations of like, my thighs are fat, no, my thighs are fatter. If you stay silent, people assume you're fine about your thighs. And I was like, I wasn't fine about my thighs. I wasn't
fine about the thighs.
I was like, I'm not fine about my body at all. And like at 15 years old, I definitely wasn't. But by not joining in on those conversations, everyone had just started assuming I was confident, to the point where I was going to start volunteering in this like confidence and self-esteem charity. And one of my friends was like, oh, what do you know about having insecurities? And I was like, wow, you've known me for 4 years and you think I have no insecurities because I just don't join in on those conversations. But by not talking about my insecurities, and originally started as not talking about the negative things about my body, but it actually turned into talking about the negative things about myself in general.
Yes, it actually swiveled it around.
Yeah,
didn't it?
And it was this almost like fake it till you make it kind of thing that happened. Mm-hmm. And I was kind of like, well, why am I putting all the focus on the things that haven't benefited me, and all the things that are still going to exist? My thighs are still going to be my thighs. Like, my scars are still going to be my scars. I mean, I must say, it meant I left high school being fine with my body, but the one exception was my scars, because basically I'd resolved to the fact that, like, from 11...
Can you describe your scars? Because you talk about them in the book, but can you tell us about them?
So my followers say it looks like a smiley face. I've had like a range of descriptions. Apparently it looks like the Kool-Aid man, but I think that's American followers, because I didn't even know who the Kool-Aid man was. And then what I used to say, it looks like an incomplete game of noughts and crosses with only the horizontal lines. But it's a ton of horizontal lines that somewhat form a scar with a smile, with my belly button being the nose.
Ah, what colour are the scar? What a colour!
They're the same colour as my skin. And
okay, so they're not red or purple.
No.
Well, that's great. So they have faded, haven't they?
Yeah, and they have faded over time. Mm. And what's funny is the most recent documentary I did, I actually had majority of comments being like, these were people who had not followed me, who didn't know who I was, and most of the comments were like, why are you talking about your scars when your fat's more noticeable? And I was literally like, oh, so they faded, clearly, because like when I talked about my scars 3 years ago, no one would be like, you can barely see them. But especially when I get a tan, you like they're still indents in my body, as in like,
yeah, I know, like lines,
but also because there's like an actual fold with one of them, because there's been maybe 6 surgeries in that one fold.
Ow.
So it's deeper and deeper. And no matter how much weight I lose,
so why
it's still
do they have
fold.
To go in your stomach if you've got a problem with your neck?
You know, that's the hardest question I've ever found to answer, because what's funny is when you go through all these surgeries as a child, you actually don't understand a lot of the medical processes behind it. And I asked this question for the first time a week ago to a doctor, and she was like, it's because they just go in through the stomach and they string it all the way up. And I was like, just from a non-medical point of view, I was like finding it really hard to picture that and how they accurately do it. And I'm like, do you just like... To me, I was just imagining like a pipe hose just being shoved up your body.
Sorry, that's what I imagined too.
And they were like, well, it's kind of like that, but you do it more delicately. And I was like, oh, okay.
And they've got to start at the base.
Yeah.
And where's it draining to, the liquid?
So it drains to...
Your bowels?
Well, I used to say my stomach, but apparently that's not accurate. But it does change. So throughout the book, I do explain that they had to move the location of my shunt, and that they do... The location of a shunt can change multiple times. And the reason mine got moved was because of an infection.
Okay.
So,
Wow, amazing, amazing. So let's go on. So you went to Bristol. You do mention, because most things in the book...
have been changed.
Bristol
hasn't been changed.
Okay, Bristol hasn't been changed. Because actually you had a very positive... It was a positive time, wasn't it?
Bristol was where I think I came into my own. Like, it was hugely liberating. I think I was so scared to go to university.
Well, you were scared, can I just say, boys, bodies, nakedness.
I was terrified. And also, I had built this massive... It'd been 7 years of me not talking about my scars, and what I'd also realised was not talking about my surgeries. And I'm sat in a interview preparing.
Oh, yeah, you're also reading psychology.
Yeah. So I'm sat in an interview preparing to interview for Oxford at the time. And it's actually the first moment I realised I've never talked about my scars until my teacher at the time asked me, oh, why do you want to study psychology? And the obvious reason being that, like, I'd gone through all these surgeries and that I feel like it's important to have, like, emotional support with that. But I definitely was not eloquent enough to say that at the time. And instead was like, oh, well, I don't know. I quite like RS. And my psychology teacher kind of stopped me and was like, why are you lying? And I was like, well, I don't want to get into Oxford because of pity. Long story short, I finally, like, get around to talking about it for the first time, but I still have in my head, like, I'd gone into hospital in the first year of primary school and the first year of secondary school, so I never had to explain it to anyone. It kind of been like my introduction to the school, and everyone knew it, and other people told the new girls and things like that, so I never really spoke about it. So I worried about how I was going to tell my new friends and also how I was going to tell boys. If I started dating someone, I couldn't hide my scars anymore because I'd take my top off in front of someone who I'd actually really care about and care about their opinion. And that would be the moment when, like, they could literally reject me and I'd be, like, scarred for the rest of my life. Pun intended. And so I had this, like, drama creating in my head and, like, this story building about, like, how it was all going to happen. And then it just happens in the silliest way possible, where we're playing a game of truth or dare during Freshers Week. We're all quite drunk. And in a moment, I forget that I have scars and I'm dared to take my top off for the next round. And I take my top off and I've actually forgotten that I have scars. Wonderful. The person who had asked me to take my top off kind of reacted to it and was like, oh, I'm so sorry, you can put your top back on. And then I kind of looked down at my stomach and I'm like, oh yeah, that's there. And so I start explaining it, and what was really funny was there were some medics in the room, so medical students as well. And it turned into this massive medical conversation, which just took off all the pressure of the emotional side of it or the personal side of it. And it was just like, oh, why do you have this condition and why do you have that? And, like, talking about all of that and
sharing at last.
Yeah, and finally talking about it. And the best part of it was the fact that it was a 10-minute conversation. And then it went back to normal. Everyone carried on their normal conversations. It wasn't like it dictated.
I want to know, did you put your top back on?
I mean, I did put my top back on quite quickly after. I mean, I felt a bit awkward after he started, like, hysterically apologising and bring more attention
but
to
you
it.
You did have boyfriends there, didn't you?
Yeah.
It did happen for you.
Yeah. And it was a clumsy journey of how to explain it, because I still had in my head that I had to preface it, because I kept saying to people, it's, like, really deceptive, because if you see me fully clothed, you can't see my scars. No. So I feel like I should warn them. And I would say this, I'd have these conversations over and over again with my friends. And they were like, why do you need to warn someone? And I just had in my head that they're signing up for a relationship with a body that, like, wasn't actually my real body, and that I would take my top off. And I think I was just most worried about the fact that I would take off my top one day and, like, a guy would run out of the room screaming. That was the nightmare that was running in my head.
But none of this ever happened.
And
it's wonderful.
I was always way more awkward about it than they were. And I mean, I think some of the best stories in the book are me, like, jumbling over my words, trying to explain my surgeries, and these guys just being a bit like, and? Yeah. Like,
let's get on with it, darling.
Yeah. They're like, I
like you. That's what they end up saying. But I like you. Yeah. Your scars aren't you.
Yeah.
That's what they say. And even though it's part of your journey, it's not your soul, is it?
And the best thing is, you think that only, in my head, it only really happens when your personality overcompensates so much for your body. But
you do have a very big personality.
But in
lovely and bubbly and massive and brilliant.
A strong personality, yeah, is how my mum used to put it. But yeah, no, it's one of those things which I actually realised that my personality didn't actually have to compensate for my body. Like, it wasn't this massive thing that I had to, like, that you could love me in spite of my body or despite my body. Like, it wasn't that. It was something I had to make up for, and that I had to be a better person or a bigger personality in order to, like, make sure you overlooked my scars. It wasn't this thing that really occurred to them. It was a bigger deal in my head than it was ever was to them. And I think that's just quite nice and reassuring when it comes to a lot of worries that women have when it comes to the bedroom. And one of the main things I say now is, like, if you're about to have sex, there are very few people in the world who would then be like, no, I'm walking out of here, just because you have a few scars on your body, or you have cellulite, or you have stretch marks, whatever you think your big problem is that's unique to you, because it's not unique.
Well, emotions and passion and maybe alcohol have taken over.
That as well, yeah, definitely.
So you go through Bristol, you're getting more and more confident, you're becoming you, really.
Yeah.
And then when was a moment you became, hang on, this is, I've done psychology, I'm now going to work, you know, helping other women with bodies. What moment again was that?
I had actually decided I was going to become a psychologist at 11 years old. So it was before Bristol, it was before I could even do psychology. I actually petitioned to get psychology as an A-level included in our school. Mm. Our school had never had psychology as an A-level, and because of the nature of our school, they said it was a soft subject and that no university would ever want it on your personal statement to apply to university. So I petitioned and I was like, we're going to get psychology as an A-level, because like my part of how I got over a lot of the trauma around my surgeries was I was like, there must be a reason I went through this, or there must be a reason why I survived this. So I had like clung on to the fact that if I became a psychologist, there would be a purpose for my life. There's a reason why I survived and other kids in the ICU didn't. And that's kind of how it started. So as much as I'd like to say that it was a really like humble thing that I decided when I was 11 years old, I think it was actually a way for me to resolve my guilt around having survived.
Also work out where this was all coming from, you know.
And it was also the thing that a lot of people had said to me, everything happens for a reason. But when you say that to an 11-year-old, they think, well, what have I done bad? Mm. That means I deserve this. Because if it happened for a reason, then I must have done something to deserve this. So I thought all the pain I'd gone through was because I'd done something really bad. So I was like, I have to do a lot of good in this world to like undo all the bad I've done, which obviously like I hadn't caused my surgeries. I hadn't done anything to deserve it. But that's how I had translated the sentence, everything happens for a reason, in my brain. So I'd kind of decided at 11 and then petitioned at A-level to get psychology in, and I'd always known and I was wanted to do psychology at university, and I kind of was a bit smug at the time because all my friends were like, what am I going to do at university? I was like, I know what I'm going to do at university, I've always known. And it was probably about like, it was actually, I went into hospital again in university, and that's when my thinking around all of it started changing, and I was like, I've wasted so much time feeling guilty, I've wasted so much time trying to undo all the damage I believe I'd done, and also like trying to make my life worth it for other people, that I was like, wait, what about me? Like, I'm gonna die having not lived my life and not lived like anything.
Yeah, you were trying to kind of be a saint.
Yeah, exactly. And what's ironic is that I was far from a saint, and I talk about this in the book, that I was a very angry child. I yelled quite a lot.
Yeah, and you were naughty actually.
Yeah.
As well.
Yeah. And I think like, that's what's funny, in my head I just had this like, I was doing good for the world, and even when I was being naughty or when I was like acting out, it was always in relation to someone's morals, it was always in relation to someone wasn't doing the right thing.
Fairness.
And I was always like big on like, you have to do the moral thing, you have to do the fair thing. Or if someone was being unkind to someone, that's usually what provoked me to start yelling or shouting, was because
good. I'm pleased about that.
Probably didn't say it the right way, I was like, you're being so immoral.
But the thing is, you've always, because you were the underdog, you're more aware of them, aren't you?
Yeah.
And all the other privileged girls there had never even thought about anybody else.
But I think that's the whole thing, was that this whole thing about gratitude is such a big thing now in terms of meditation and things like that. But at the time when you're forcing gratitude down someone's throat who's going through so much pain...
Children don't understand gratitude. Yeah. I don't think you do till you're about 18.
But I think I was like trying to force myself to be grateful for everything I'd gone through.
God,
like,
but how could you? Because it didn't make mental sense.
Yeah. I mean, it was even things like, I got told that my brain tumour actually was... So they accidentally punctured my intestines in hospital. And they said... And it was like, this massive thing, could have easily been sued for it. But instead, I got told, oh, you should be grateful, because if it wasn't for that, they wouldn't have found your brain tumour. And I was like, now, as an adult, I'm a bit like, wait, so I should be grateful for the tumour that you didn't find for 11 years, and that the only reason you found it is because you made another mistake, created my biggest scar, and also the thing that's affected my like chronic pain the most. But I should be grateful because as a result, you found a brain tumor that lived inside my body for 11 years. Like, all of that, there is no gratitude in that. I'm allowed to be angry about that. And it was also the thing of, I think a lot of the reason I wanted to go into psychology was I didn't really appreciate how I was treated by psychologists. And this thing about, as soon as I got diagnosed with a brain tumor, them wanting to diagnose me with depression. And I was like, you tell an adult that they have a brain tumor and see how they react. Like, they'd probably be just as sad or angry as I was. But I got diagnosed because I was 11 years old with temper tantrums. And it's funny because it just like empowered me as I got older, because I was like, you should have like, that isn't a diagnosis. You don't diagnose someone with temper tantrums when you don't, when you take that out of context from what I've actually just been through, because that's anger and that's healthy anger and you're allowed to express that. And this shutting down of it by diagnosing it and medicating it isn't helping anyone.
Awful, awful. You did have a very big mistrust of therapists, but I don't want to talk about, I want to talk about how you actually have become a body positive life coach. What are the steps you took? I know you read psychology, but what did you do a course afterwards? Or
yeah, so I the thing that kind of broke my dream of being a psychologist was I got diagnosed with PTSD in my final year of university.
Can you explain what that is?
Post-traumatic stress disorder. So they basically thought that all of the trauma, which I found it really hard to accept that I'd gone through trauma, had built up. And because I had smothered it in gratitude and smothered it in all the reasons why it was a good thing, I had never actually felt the anger that was there and the sadness that was there. And it kind of all culminated in me just crying hysterically nonstop for about 3 months, which kind of put a halt to my third year of university. And it was about a month before I was graduating and I had one final essay to do, and I had my dissertation to put in and I was like, I need to graduate. But the thing that kept going around my head was I wanted to apply to for a master's to become a psychologist. And I was like, how am I going to be a psychologist when therapy didn't work for me? And I ended up quitting therapy after 4 months. So I ended up graduating having no clue what I wanted to do. And that smug thing of where I was like, I know what I want to do in university came back to bite me. And that us being like, oh, wait, I know, don't know what I want to do. And now I've actually graduated with a degree that might be useless now. But what I didn't know was at its essence, I did love psychology. I did find humans fascinating and how humans tick and emotions in general. So I was like, I'm just going to start doing a few courses whilst I decided I was going on a gap year. Because I was like, I just need a year to not...
Especially after the crying and everything.
Yeah, and I was also like, I need a year to not be responsible. I'd grown up in a school where like I'd worked nonstop. I was always a very like focused, hardworking person. I was like, I just need a year.
Especially from your culture, from your mum's culture as
Definitely.
Well.
Definitely. And like, that's always encouraged in Asia. And I think it was just this, like, I need a year to just be a child. So I went off to, so I was like, I'm going to go off to Australia and then New Zealand and do all of this. But I never actually got there because in the 3 months before I left, I started doing courses. And the more I did these courses, I fell in love with them. And I was like, wait, this is psychology. It's just different. And in the meantime, I'd gone to a more holistic therapist who was trained in hypnotherapy and a technique called Havening. And it had worked. It got rid of all my crying. All of my PTSD symptoms were gone.
Brilliant.
And it had been months of me not experiencing any symptoms. And I was like, whatever he's trained in, I want to get trained in. So I got ended up getting trained in neuro-linguistic programming.
NLP.
Havening. Havening, timeline therapy, NLP coaching.
You went the You always go for it, don't you, Michelle?
I don't do things in halves. So I went, I mean, I also trained intensively. So I trained up, got qualified. And then when I was finished, I was like, wait, what do I do now? Like, do I go?
Who do I help?
Yeah. And my trainer at the time was like, you start a business because like people don't hire life coaches. And I was like, oh, okay, so I'm now 21 years old starting a business, which I've never wanted to start in my... Like, my passion was never to start a business. My passion was to help people. And what's funny is that I trained with all like 40-year-olds, 50-year-olds, yes. and I was the
people kind of going through a life change. Yeah, and they want a new career.
And like a new yeah. career. And mm. I was the I was again the underdog. Everyone underestimated me. It was like, how are you going to help people at 21 years old? So I just sat down, and a lot of the coaching staff, because when you train as a coach, you actually have to be the client and then the coach. A lot of it was around your mindset, and I was like, okay, well, everyone's saying that me being young is a negative. What's my positive? And I was like, well, I understand social media, and they don't, so I'm going to use that to my benefit. And I was the first person out of our entire class to have a full roster of clients to be working, and nearly every single person who came to me had body confidence issues. And so one of the main things that you're told when you're like coaching is or you can't be a life coach, because a life coach is too broad, because you can't just coach everyone on like life, so you need to choose a niche. Mm-hmm. And so this whole time I was like, I need a niche, I need a niche, and I have no clue what my niche is. But it's really funny looking back at my life, because everything kind of led to me focusing in on confidence. My dissertation was about confidence. Like, all of this in hindsight, I'm like, how did I not see this? I'd worked in 4 confidence charities in university. Like, I'd always cared about confidence, but I specifically cared about body confidence. And so I started working with that, and it was this really interesting thing, because I remember Googling it at the time, and no body confidence coaches existed. So I was like, I'm just gonna create this title. Like, I don't know if it makes sense. And at the time, everyone thought it was code for sex therapist, because it just didn't exist. And I remember saying to my trainer, like, is it weird that I've just made up a job title? And he was like, no, you'll just be the world's first body confidence coach.
Yay.
And now if you Google it, it's like 10 pages on Google of body confidence coaches.
So you're
like,
number one.
Yeah, so I was like, I was the world's first body confidence coach. Mm. But it was, the more I worked in it, the more I realised the need for it was because, like, all these...
Do you think every woman needs it?
And also, every woman is limiting their life and limiting their potential and their power by obsessing about their body. Because how much... I just think back to when I was really insecure, and the amount of hours, the amount of energy in my day that I would...
Worrying
or thinking you're not good enough, or turning down opportunities, turning down events. There's 17% of people don't go to job interviews if they don't like what they look like. And like 17% sounds small, but a job interview, like to get a job interview is hard enough, and to not turn up because you don't like what you look like. It's things like that which just make me so sad, in the fact that like 97% of women have a I hate my body moment every day.
I've even had I hate my stomach moment this morning. Yeah,
and it happens, and it's just, we need to stop normalizing it. It's not, it's
also we're putting something negative onto ourselves all the time, and that will drag us down eventually.
Yeah, and it's this pressure, which like, we've set this standard so high for what beautiful is, and it's constantly changing that no one can match it. Like, as soon as you feel like you've got, like, which I don't think anyone feels like this, but hypothetically feels like, oh, you've got the body of your dream, they change the script of like what's perfect and what's beautiful, and they create new things. Like, someone started talking to me yesterday about hip dips. Apparently that's a new insecurity, and I was like, what the hell is a hip dip? And it's like, oh, it's this thing where your hip suddenly like drops inside, like drops like thinner into your body, so then it looks like you've got bigger hips. And I was like, people are creating insecurities. Like, there's one study which I love. It's not even a study, it's a fact. It's that people weren't insecure about cellulite until Vogue in the 1970s stuck it on their cover and called it a problem. Until then, photos weren't photoshopped removing cellulite, because it was never considered not beautiful.
An ugly thing,
Within a year of them putting it on the Vogue cover and saying it was a problem that needed to be fixed, there were cellulite creams everywhere. There were, here are exercises to fix.
Someone's making a lot of money out of
exactly.
our cellulite.
And this is, the more you work in this industry, you start to sound like, it's
making money out of
profiting your insecurities. And they create new ones so that they keep making more money. And what, the diet industry in America is $60 billion, and in England it's $2 billion, but it's way too much. And all of this is limiting mainly women, but also men's power. And it means they don't live their life. And I guess that's the part I'm most passionate about, is because I've gone through all of these like life and death experiences, I'm like, do you realize that, like, you don't necessarily get to live till you're 90? Like, you could die when you're 19 and then you're lying in a hospital bed thinking about every single opportunity you haven't done. That's actually the pivotal moment in my body confidence was when I was hospitalized when I was 19, and I was like, it took me 15 surgeries to finally appreciate my body. Like, even at operation 7, I wasn't like appreciating my body. It was like 15, I was like, wait, hold on, I might not have much longer. It's why I started writing my book. I literally, in that hospital bed, was like, I need to write this. I need to leave a legacy somewhere. I started just not creating these excuses for not doing things, because I was like, what if I have no time left? And I think we all realize we're going to die, but we don't emotionally realize that. And it's quite scary to emotionally realize that. And I've gone through the emotional side of it, and it's exhausting and tiring and painful. But we kind of do need to realize it a bit more in order to actually make the most of our life. And one of the main things that, like, I really believe in is, like, you shouldn't have to go through the pain that I went through in order to appreciate your body. Like, why wait until you're bedridden, until you can do that? And in a way, like, I hate to put a positive spin on what I've, like, gone through, but, like, in a way, I'm grateful that I did go through it at 19, because, like, the worst part is most people only experience the illnesses I went through at 90 when it's too late. And so you don't have any time to make up for it.
So you've got wisdom quickly. Yeah, that's the thing you must be grateful for.
Yeah, I mean,
I never really
understood it when I was growing up, but I was always told I was wiser than my years. And I was like, I guess I went through things that weren't meant to be age appropriate at the time.
Okay, because we're getting to the end of the interview now. I just want you to give us one way that women, a little tip, women can feel better about their bodies today. Just tell us one.
I think you should just start wearing, especially now in this heat wave, start wearing what you want. Because, like, no matter what you think is, like, I don't know, people have these rules about, like, you can't wear this until you're this size. Or, like, whatever you have at the end of the sentence, which goes, like, when I lose 10 pounds, I'm going to. Start working on it now. You're fully capable of doing it now. Stop putting your life on pause until you lose those 5-10 pounds. Your life has already started, and you need to start using it now. And that's the main thing, is that whatever's at the end of that sentence where you believe you're going to start having the perfect job, or you're going to change jobs, or you're going to find a perfect relationship, what is wrong with right now? What is wrong with your body now that you can't do any of those things? So look at...
If you can stand up and walk out of a room, you're doing all right, aren't you?
Yeah. And also just like... I think we also just need to raise the standard of how other people treat us. And if someone body shames you, and if someone speaks negatively about your body, then you are entirely entitled to walk out of the room and just not accept that treatment.
What do you say if someone says something to you like, oh, well, you're fat, or, you know, what would you do?
Well, when they say I'm fat, I'm like, yeah, and you have eyes. Like, yeah. Fat is not a negative word. Yeah. We've only turned it into a negative word.
It's, I mean, I was even scared of saying it then.
Yeah, but I was like, it's a fact. Yeah. You know, the funniest thing is, because of the title of my book, I've noticed the, like, knee-jerk reactions to the word ugly. Like, people almost, like, spit it out of their mouths when they say the title of my book. And then when I'm like, oh, I've written a book, and they're like, oh, what's it called? Yeah, and I'm like, am I ugly? And they're like, what? But why would you...
What, and I was become, like, speechless.
Yeah. Why would you call your book that? You're not ugly. And I was like, oh, I didn't say I was ugly. I was just asking a question. But it's this thing, like, where these words are so... Especially fat is so heavily stigmatized. But if it was actually just the same as the word tall, and we just reacted it to the same as the word tall, if someone said, oh, you're, like, oh, you're tall, you wouldn't be like, no, you're not tall. Don't worry. I was like, I can see my body. I can see I'm fat. I don't understand what's so negative about it. Like, I don't understand why we, like, whisper it, or there's so much shame around it.
Yeah, I whispered it then, because I was scared of something.
But,
no, but there is shame. There's this complete... It's we spend our life trying to avoid it, don't
exactly.
we?
And it's all the associations. Fat equals ugly, fat equals lazy, fat equals, like, disorganized, all those things, like, all those stereotypes that are played out in the media.
But I know you're very motivated, very dynamic, very in, you know, your life is completely on the ball. I just think what you're doing, everything you've said today has been moving, inspiring, I think you're the bravest person. I think you're inspirational, and massive congratulations on your
so
book. Thank you so much for coming onto Radio Gorgeous.
I'm so glad you like it. Thank you so much for having me.
And just to let you know, I read it in two nights.
Oh my gosh. Okay.
So, Am I Ugly by Michelle Ellman is published by Head of Zeus. And for more amazing life stories, always go to radiogorgeous.com. Thanks so much.
Thank you.